Okay, so thank you very much for the introduction. So Callinicus, this work is a part of the PhD thesis of my former student, Ricardo Padilha, who unfortunately he could not come here to present the work. So storage is a pretty fundamental resource, and many systems have been proposed to handle storage. We already had examples in this conference, in some of the sessions yesterday. And many of the storage systems that exist, they are subject to a trade-off that involves performance and consistency. For example, if you take traditional databases, they offer strong consistency in the form of serializability, or perhaps what's more common today, snapshot isolation, at the cost of very limited scalability, if any scalability at all. Now, if you look at the other end of the spectrum, like key-value stores, they provide usually excellent scalability, sometimes linear with the number of the nodes. On the other hand, they provide what is generally known as weak consistency in things like causal consistency and eventual consistency and so on. Now, in this space of different storage systems, there is one system that stands out in the sense that it is not subject to this trade-off, and that's mini transactions, something that was introduced a few years ago. So Callinicus, the system we designed and implemented, is based on the idea of the mini transactions. So mini transactions is an elegant idea. So it has a simple transactional language. In fact, there are only three operations. There are compares, so equality comparisons. There is operations to read data items in the storage and to write data items. And an application designer can use any number of operations in a mini transaction. So it also, mini transactions have a very simple execution model. The idea is that if all the compares, all the equality comparisons are successful, then the reads and the writes are going to be executed. Right? So the reads, they return the values of the keys in the storage to the application. And also mini transactions, they're amenable to optimize the implementation. So the storage space is partitioned, and each partition is assigned to a server. And in a mini transaction, it is also divided into sub-transactions, one sub-transaction per partition. Right? So to make sure that the transactions are atomic, they either commit at all partitions or non-partitions, there is a two-phase commit at the end that coordinates the sub-transactions. So although many transactions are great, they are not free of problems, and I'd like to mention three of them. So the first one, like being too restrictive, I'm going to illustrate with an example which I'll be using throughout this talk. So this example is to swap two entries in a database. Or in the storage. So entries A and B, so here is the high-level transaction that will do that. So I guess this is self-explaining. It's pretty obvious what it does, right? Now, it turns out that this very simple computation cannot be implemented in a mini-transaction. And the reason is, so there are two reasons. The first one is kind of obvious. So mini-transactions, they don't have the notion of variables, so it will be impossible to actually have a variable X receiving the value of some entry. But there is another reason, which is more fundamental, which is in mini transactions, you cannot have information flowing from one partition to another within a transaction. So what would happen, for example, if entries A and B, they were assigned to different partitions? So there is no way for the value of A to go to the partition where B is stored. So in fact, if you want to implement a swap using mini transactions, you have to use two mini transactions. The first mini transaction is going to read entries A and B, and then the second mini transaction is going to perform the updates. Now, you cannot just do the updates in the second mini transaction. First, you have to use the compare operations, which essentially what they do here in these mini transactions is to make sure that the value that you read in the first transaction is still valid, is still the same value in the second transaction. And the reason why you need to do this is because these are two independent transactions, so atomicity doesn't apply for both of them, only applies for a single mini transaction. So some other transaction could change the values of A or B in between these two transactions. And if you don't test the contents of A and B in the second mini transaction, the execution would not be serializable. So if the second mini transaction cannot commit, what the application logic has to do is it has to retry. And so on until the second transaction gets committed. So that brings me to the second limitation of mini transactions, which has to do with abort rates, especially in workloads that are subject to contention. So mini transactions, they implement optimistic concurrence control. So they use short locks, which essentially means that if one transaction acquires locks on some data items, and a second transaction tries to access those data items, the second transaction is going to be aborted. Now, the other reason is the other reason why they may be subject to high abort rates is because of what I showed before, right? Sometimes, depending on the computation you want to perform, you have to divide the transaction in two or more mini transactions, and then the second one may actually abort. Now, abort rates is something that, I guess, we all agree it's something bad. It has a negative impact on throughput. So here is the graph on the top. It shows that as I increase the number of clients, my throughput is going to decrease because there's more transactions actually changed the values of my items, and then more transactions are going to fail the compare test I had before. Now, it also has a negative impact on latency because from the application, the logic's perspective, if there's an abort, the transaction has to be submitted, and then it's going to take some time until it gets committed. So the third problem with mini transactions is that they were designed to address crash failures as opposed to more general failures like Byzantine failures, which lead to more robust systems. So this is the slide that I'd like you to remember from this talk. This paper proposes Kalinicus, which introduces the notion of armored transactions. And armored transactions, they address the three problems that I mentioned before. So they allow unrestricted operations, and they allow data flow across partitions. They also have contention management, which avoids aborts. And finally, they can tolerate Byzantine failures. Now, they achieve these three properties without giving up on the main highlights of mini transactions, which are strong consistency, in this case here, strict serializability, and scalable performance. So just like mini transactions, they are not subject to the performance versus consistency trade-off, armored transactions are not either. Okay, so Kalinicus is a fairly complex system, and it would be very hard for me to go through all the details. What I will do next is give you some hints, or actually some intuition, behind each one, how Kalinicus addresses each one of these problems. So for the first one, Kalinicus provides a richer language. If I'm back to my swapping example, this high-level transaction here, it could be implemented just like it is shown in this slide. And in order to be executed, the application programmer has to provide what we call a transaction matrix for the swap. And the transaction matrix, what it does essentially, it distributes the operations of this transaction in many rounds, and also across different partitions. So what you need actually to generate the transaction matrix is the description of the transaction and the actual location of the data. So right now, this is done by the application programmer, as I said. We are working on trying to automatize this process. So in this example here, data item A is in partition 1, and data item B is in partition 2. Another important thing from the transaction matrix is that every data flow, it happens across round boundaries. So in the first round, partition 1 is going to read data item A, and then it's going to export it, which essentially in the second round is going to be passed to the partition 2, and vice versa, so that their writes can actually perform. Now, an important difference is that all this computation, it happens within a single transaction, as opposed to two different transactions, as in the mean transaction abstraction. So from the transaction matrix, let me show how the execution proceeds. So here I have a client and two partitions. So the partitions are represented by thick lines. In reality, what the partitions are is a set of replicas. In this case here, I want to tolerate a single failure, so I need four replicas. But to simplify my example, I'm going to use just this bold lines. But within each partition, the computation is handled using state machine replication. And in the particular case of our prototype, is using PBFT. So the execution proceeds as follows. In the first round, the client uses PBFT to send the transaction matrix to all involved partitions. So the partitions, they try to lock all data items, not only the ones that are stored locally, but they try to get locks on all data items of the transaction matrix, and then they execute the operation in the first round, and then return the result to the client. In the second round, the client exports the items that were read in the first round to the respective partitions, which are going to execute the commands assigned to the second round. And then at the end of the second round, they send the results of this execution, and then the client can communicate the partitions what was the outcome of the transaction, whether it was a commit or an abort. Now, if I generalize the approach, there's a difference between the first round and the other rounds. So in the first round, the client multicasts the transaction matrix, as I said, using PBFT. The replicas, they acquire all the locks, and then they execute the computation assigned to the first round, and then return the signed vote and the data. So all the data returned by the partition has to be signed because we also want to protect against Byzantine clients. And a Byzantine client could just lie to the partitions about what it received in the previous rounds. So to avoid this, all the data returned by the partitions at the end of a round has to be signed. And in all the other rounds that come after the first, essentially what happens is that the client sends the data it received in the previous round, the replicas receive this data, they execute the computation, and they return the signed vote and the data. The client collects the signed information, and so it goes on until the last round of the transaction. Now, with respect to the second problem, the approach that's taken by Kalinicus is that instead of aborting transactions, in case of conflicts, like the mini transactions do, what Kalinicus does is it tries to order transactions that conflict. But it does that based on demand. If there is no conflict, so transactions are, there's no logic to try to order the transaction, but whenever there is a conflict, then it tries to order them. So this example here shows a case where ordering transactions would be needed. We have two clients, both of them are submitting a swap transaction concurrently. And in the first partition, the transaction submitted by the first client arrives before the transaction submitted by the second client. So the partition one acquires all the locks for this transaction. It executes the first round and returns the data to the client. Now, at the second partition, because partition two has done the same for the transaction from client two, it detects a conflict and then it can't acquire the locks. Now, at this point, it returns to the client an indication that there was a conflict so that the conflict can be handled. Now, the reason why we don't simply enqueue the locks is because, obviously, if you do that, you'd run into a deadlock, which wouldn't be good, right? So what happens next is the client passes the additional information, so T1 and T2 stand for timestamps that are assigned by the partitions, and based on these timestamps that are received from each partition, the partitions, they determine the final timestamp of the transaction, right, the max between the two timestamps assigned to the partition, and then, if needed, they reorder the locks based on this final timestamp and re-execute the transaction. Now, the only difference, really, is the ordering round, right? After the ordering round, the rest of the execution is just like I showed before, so it's going to continue with the second round and so on. So in general terms, so here is what happens. So I have to revise the execution of my first round. So in reality, servers, they assign a timestamp to the transactions, and the locks are acquired based on this timestamp. And then the servers, they return the timestamps as part of the data that is returned from the partitions to the client. So, and if there's a conflict, they also notify the client that there was a conflict. The client collects all this signed information. And then if there is a conflict, then it goes through an ordering round. So in the ordering round, the client sends all the signed timestamps to the partitions. The partitions are going to compute the final timestamp. Possibly they have to reacquire locks if the final timestamp is not the same as the timestamp used locally by the partition. And also, perhaps it has to re-execute the commands that were executed in the first round. And then all the data is returned to the client, which collects it and continues to the second round. The mechanism to cope with Byzantine attacks is based on some previous work. So for Byzantine servers, since the approach is based on state machine replication for Byzantine failures, we essentially rely on PBFT to handle failures of Byzantine servers, right? For Byzantine clients, Kalinicus borrows from Augustus, which is a system that implements mini transactions for Byzantine failures. And it is guarantees safety in all cases, right? It doesn't violate strict serializability. And it offers guarantees to some liveness attacks. For example, the case in which a malicious client leaves some transaction unfinished, so it doesn't execute the whole round for all the partitions, so the transaction is going to be dangling. So what happens here is that correct clients, whenever they detect a conflict, they're going to finish this transaction. And, but we do not claim to provide complete absolute liveness guarantees. So there are some attacks that can be attempted by Byzantine clients, like flooding the system with many transactions, so we don't account for those kind of attacks. It's even, I guess, an open question whether it would be possible to also account for such attacks. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about some of our performance evaluation. So the system has been fully implemented in Java, both the PBFT and the transaction processing engine. And we also implemented two applications to test to benchmark Kalinicus. The first one is Cassia, is a distributed message queue. The reason why we chose this application is because message queues, they represent a natural point of contention, right? The tail of the queue is where all the producers, they try to add messages. And Buzzer is the distributed graph store, something like a social network. And the reason for Buzzer is that it provides configurable contention depending on the structure of my graph. I won't show you any results about Buzzer. You can find those in the paper. But I will detail now the Cassia benchmark and also some of the results we found with it. So there are two roles in Cassia. There's the producers, which add messages to the queue. And producers, they contend with other producers and with consumers. So every message that's added to the queue is going it requires exclusive access to the tail. So there's contention between producers. Now, the consumers, they do not remove messages from the queue. They simply scan the whole queue. So by doing that, there is no contention between consumers among themselves. There is contention between consumers and producers. So this slide here, it shows the code that represents these two roles. So the producer, it reads the tail of the queue, and it increments it to the next location. So it adds a data item to the next location, and then it updates the tail of the queue. And the consumers, what they do, they read the head of the queue, the tail of the queue, and then they issue a range query to return all the items in between the head and the tail. So the first result I'd like to share with you is about the scalability of Kalinicus. In this benchmark here, there is one queue per partition, and there are six producers per partition. So what we did in this experiment, we increased the number of partitions. And as we can see, throughput increases almost proportionally to the number of partitions. So the reason why this happens is because Kalinicus does not rely on any centralized entity to execute. Now, the second performance highlight is perhaps the worst case scenario for the mini transactions, which is a situation in which there is high contention. In this case here, we are increasing the number of producers. And what you can see, so the graph on the top that shows throughput, is that as with mini transactions, as the number of producers increases, as there's more contention, what's going to happen is that throughput is going to decrease. I already showed this graph before. Right? The reason why throughput decreases with mini transactions is because the producer's logic, it has to be decomposed into two mini transactions, and then you run into the problem that we had before. In the case of Kalinicus, because it doesn't really abort transactions because of contention, what it actually does is it orders these transactions. If I increase the number of producers, my performance gets better until the point where the servers are just not able to process further transactions, and which happens actually with four producers. And after that point, the throughput remains stable. Now, if you look at latency, there is some increase in the latency for the Kalinicus. This happens because although there's no abort, there is still contention for other system resources like CPU, for example. So as I increase the number of producers, there is an increase in latency, but it's significantly lower than the increase that exists in mini transactions because of the abort and the retries. Now the final performance highlight is the other end of the spectrum is the best case for mini transactions, which is completely absence of contention. So here in this case, I only have consumers executing. So it means that no mini transaction is going to be aborted, right? Because they're not changing the content of the system. Now, what you can see here is that in the complete absence of contention, Kalinicus keeps up with mini transactions. So it doesn't have the same result, but it's very close to what you can achieve with mini transactions, both in terms of throughput and in terms of latency. So to conclude, this paper introduces Kalinicus. And Kalinicus, it does essentially three things. So it extends mini transactions to handle unrestricted operations and also to allow data flow across partitions. It has a contention management that avoids aborts by ordering transactions. And it can also tolerate Byzantine failures. And again, it achieves all these things without giving up strong consistency, which in this case is strict serializability, and without compromising performance, which is just the two main properties of mini transactions. And with that, I conclude my talk. Thank you very much.
Yes, we have time for questions, please.
I was wondering what happens if clients fail or disconnect from one of the partitions.
Right. So
That was Alex Scherer from Google. So yeah, try to remember to tell who you are so we learn.
So in that case would be what we'd call unfinished transactions. So it can happen because, I don't know, some well-intentioned client failed, or because some malicious client just did not submit the whole transaction. So this transaction, it's going to remain pending in the system, right, until a transaction submitted by a correct client conflicts with this, and then it's going to finish it, because it's going to detect the conflict, and then it's going to submit the two of them, it's going to order them, and it's going to finish them. So that's what I meant by correct clients, they solve unfinished transactions.
Hi. Stefan Belmont, Google as well. I guess we're interested in these kind of distributed systems. Huh? I have Spanner in mind and Megastore in these kind of systems. Can you go back to your performance slides? So, right, I mean, obviously here you are talking about all nodes on a single site, correct? I mean, the network latency between nodes is effectively zero, correct?
Oh, it's definitely not zero, but all these experiments I didn't mention, I think it's a fair question. They were run within a single cluster.
Right. So if I were to run this across, say, wide area networks with tens of milliseconds, are we effectively getting, you know, the optimal behavior that is Paxos effectively between nodes, as in, you know, two round trips or one round trip, depending on which round you're in?
Well, I guess the answer to that question, it really depends on, I can illustrate this with this slide here, sorry. That's the first part of the first round, is the time it takes for the client to submit the transaction matrix to the partitions. Now, I'm showing this as a single arrow, but I labeled it as PBFT. So in reality, there are four rounds of communication going on here. Now, and if you'd like to optimize this, you could either try to replace PBFT by one of the many systems that have been proposed in the literature to reduce the latency of state machine application, like ZZVAF, for example, can do the two communication steps.
Right.
In reality, the way you order these transactions is completely orthogonal to Kalinicus. What it requires is that servers within a partition, they are going to receive the transaction matrix in the same order.
Okay, so right now that's really a stretch, but on your very first slide, you talked about causal consistency as being weak, and you know it is. There's that famous paper about it had a very catchy title. Don't settle for eventual, I think the title was, about how you can definitely do better than just purely eventual. Does this then have? Since you said it's orthogonal, is there any application to weaker systems in terms of properties, or am I just totally confused? Probably
not. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Let's say I don't want strict serializability.
If you could optimize the system for a weaker level.
Right, exactly. Could I get some of your goodness, but on a weak? Because the problem with strict serializability is you have round trip on the WAN, right, on the wide area network. And that's all nice and good, but. And no offense to the Spanner guys, but obviously you have limits to what you can do there.
Right. To be very frank with you, I never considered this issue, so I don't really know. Right? So anything I'm going to say here is just going to be a speculation. And I'd be tempted to say that you could do it, but the truth is, as I said, Kalinicus is a fairly complicated system because it tolerates Byzantine failures. Now, I wonder what would be replaced here by causal consistency. Let's say you could replace PBFT by causal consistency.
Right.
I'm not sure how you handle that.
Yeah, the last question.
Hey, Ning Gao from University of Colorado Boulder. So I'm just wondering what is your partitioning strategy is? Like, is certain cases for certain workloads, there might be hotspots in there. So, like, if you wanted to build you talk about the distributed data structures. Right. If you're building like a distributed B tree, the root nodes is always contended for. So how do you deal with that contention? Yes.
So,
thank you.
There is nothing in Kalinicus that that requires one partitioning scheme instead of another. But for performance, so what I mean by that is you can use any partitioning scheme you want, right? But for performance reasons, the partitioning may have a big impact. For example, in this case here, you have to know where you're going to submit your transaction matrix, right? And you have to do that before you actually execute the transactions. So if you can't tell which partitions are going to be involved in your MIDI transaction, in your Armor transaction, you have to send two partitions, right? So depending on how you partition your data, it has an impact on performance. But for the reasons that you said, different applications have different needs. We are not tied to any single partitioning scheme.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.